ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to non-human animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about why a plant-based diet is not only the best for humans, but also the best thing that one can do for the planet.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Reverend Gary Kowalski, author of books on nature, history, and spirituality, including Blessings of the Animals, Celebrating Our Kinship with All Creation, and The Souls of Animals. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
The Independent reports that thousands of animal welfare supporters took to the streets of central London to protest against the controversial badger cull policy, which came into effect June 1st. Many of the protesters were dressed in black and white and chanted, "Shame on DEFRA," and "Stop the cull." Some were walking dogs dressed in badger costumes. Under the new regulations, over 5,000 free-running badgers can now be shot by trained marksmen. The protesters were led by the former Queen guitarist Brian May, who delivered a petition with over 200,000 signatures against the cull to Downing Street. The cull claims to reduce the outbreaks of tuberculosis in dairy and beef herds, which led to the slaughter of 28,000 cattle in England last year. Culling 70% of badgers in a particular area, cull supporters say, can reduce the disease by 16%. Protesters argue that the cull is ineffective and unethical.
From the New York Times, a new report catalogs a range of problems with the way the federal government is managing thousands of wild horses and burros that roam the American West, supporting the position of animal rights advocates who have long argued that the program is ineffective and needlessly cruel. The report, conducted by the National Academy of Sciences, at the behest of the Bureau of Land Management, concluded that the Bureau's methods of counting the thousands of wild horses and burros that wander rural stretches of the United States were inconsistent and mostly inaccurate. It also said that the Bureau's policy of removing the animals from the range and taking them to holding facilities as a means of population control, an approach that has drawn sharp criticism from wild horse proponents, did not work. An icon of frontier mythology, wild horses, which trace their lineage to United States cavalry horses, work horses, and horses brought by Spanish settlers, have been at the center of an increasingly bitter dispute over the past few years. The Bureau contends that their numbers have become unmanageable, and it says it has little choice but to bring them to enclosed pastures so that other animals can share the land. Horse advocates counter that the horses should be allowed to live freely. The Bureau estimates that about 37,000 wild horses and burros roam on federally managed rangeland in 10 western states, and that nearly 50,000 additional animals are being cared for at short-term corrals and long-term pastures. With essentially no natural predators, herds typically double every 4 years. The report recommended that more fertility control drugs be used as an alternative, a departure from the Bureau's current approach. According to the Bureau, the program's budget ballooned to $75 million in 2012 from about $20 million in 2000, driven primarily by the rising costs of holding horses and burros. In its research, the National Academy of Sciences did not specifically address the issue of roundups, which involve helicopters corralling wild horses into traps and have become a rallying cry for critics who say they are dangerous and inhumane. Nonetheless, horse advocates said the findings affirm their concerns by calling for changes in the program.
In a move questioned by some of the world's leading wolf researchers, the Obama administration announced plans earlier this month to prematurely strip Endangered Species Act protections from gray wolves across most of the lower 48 states, abruptly ending one of America's most important species recovery programs. Wolves today occupy just 5% of their historic habitat in the continental United States. And this recent proposal to remove protections means that wolves will never fully recover or reoccupy prime wolf habitat in the southern Rocky Mountains, California, and the Northeast. The proposal will hand wolf management over to state wildlife agencies across most of the country, a step that has meant widespread killing in recent years. Following the removal of protection for wolves in the northern Rocky Mountains and western Great Lakes in 2011, states in those regions quickly enacted aggressive hunting and trapping seasons designed to drastically reduce wolf populations. In the northern Rocky Mountains, more than 1,000 wolves have been killed since protections were removed. To learn more about how protections for wolves are being removed, please go to biologicaldiversity.org.
Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with Reverend Gary Kowalski. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on ACT Radio is Reverend Gary Kowalski. Thanks for joining us, Gary.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hi, Gary. Can we start out by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you first got involved working with animal issues?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had kind of a personal awakening. It was about 25 years ago. I'd never thought much about animals. And what opened my mind and my heart was this experience of hearing about Coco and her kitten. Coco was the gorilla who had learned sign language out in California. A lot of people know her story now. And she adopted this little cat, and they bonded and became fast friends. And then the kitten was accidentally killed when the cat escaped from the compound at the Gorilla Foundation where Coco lived. And, you know, Coco was very upset about that, but what struck me about this story the first time I heard it was someone who worked with Coco was able to interview her to ask about how much she understood of what had happened. And Coco was asked in sign language, why do gorillas die? And supposedly she made the signs for trouble and old. And then Coco was asked, where do gorillas go when they die? And she made the signs for comfortable, hole, like a hole in the ground, and then the sign for goodbye, which is, you know, touching your lips with your fingers and blowing a farewell kiss. And finally, Coco was asked, how do gorillas feel when they die? Are they happy, sad, afraid? And Coco made the sign for sleep. Now, I think what struck me was that just at that point in my own life, my grandfather had passed away a couple months previously, and I lost my dad when I was just a child, so he was like the main male parent figure in my life, and I was really struggling with his loss. You know, I had been to divinity school, I'd been ordained, I was serving my first church at that point, but, you know, how you face death and the end of life and where you find hope and comfort and courage, those are questions and answers that they don't teach you in school and that you can't learn from books. You kind of have to live it and work it out for yourself. And like I said, I was grieving and struggling how to make sense of this. And something about Coco's story just touched me and opened my heart. It was like a great wave of compassion came over me. And I realized that my own loss wasn't just my loss. I realized that I wasn't the only individual on the planet struggling with these questions of healing and recovery. You know, that I was part of a larger story that included Coco and her kitten, a story of life and evolution that had been occurring for millions and millions of years, a much bigger story than my own. So it was like I'd lost a member of my own family, but I realized I was a part of a much bigger family. And that was really what was the genesis of my first book, The Souls of Animals, because I started wondering, you know, about animals. What did I missed if they were aware of death like people. What else were other species aware of? Did they appreciate art or music? Did other creatures have a moral sense? Why did they play? What did they dream about? What goes on inside those furry heads of theirs?
Gary, that's really incredible. And it's something we all come to terms with, is how much like us are they? It's a question that I think about all the time. And science seems to be discovering every day
They certainly do, and the public is becoming educated, too. You know, when The Souls of Animals came out in 1991, not much had been written on this topic. And like I was describing how elephants have funerals and will bury their family members when they die, this is well-documented and well-known now, but it was so new when I put it out just a little over 20 years ago that my publisher was incredulous. They said, you're not making this up. I said, no, this is all documented.
I lost a cat a couple of months ago. She was my companion for 15 years, and I loved her very much. And she knew she was dying, and she said goodbye to me. It was the clearest communication that I've had from her in a long time.
Mm-hmm. I'm very sorry about your loss. Yeah, I think often animals do sense when their time has come, and probably they go through some of the same stages that people go through. You know, as a clergy person, I work with families whose loved ones are at the end of life, and Kubler-Ross describes the final stage as one of with withdrawal, when people kind of turn inward to go on that final journey. And that's what animals often do, too. You know, innumerable people have told me about their cats who are experiencing kidney failure or other conditions where their time is short. And often they'll, go under the porch or into a safe space, an isolated space to be alone in that final moment.
And I imagine as a parish minister, you probably had quite a bit of your congregation come up to you and trying to deal with this type of loss.
Well, I do. People come to me frequently, and I've often, presided at memorials for animal companions. In fact, that was, kind of the genesis of my second book, Goodbye Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who's Ever Lost a Pet, because, the attitudes are changing somewhat, but the loss of an animal is still often just minimized. Oh, it's a dog. It's just a cat. You'll get over it. Move on.
Or you can just get another one.
Right.
People say that, you can just get another dog, and you're like, I don't want another dog right now.
Yeah.
You're not prepared for that right at that moment.
Right. The emotions are the same, and sometimes they're more intense in the case of an animal because, I think the bond we have with our pets is so pure, so uncomplicated, so direct that the pain can also be just very pure and intense when they go.
Now, I guess people often think of souls as something sort of simple that survives you once you die. In your research, what was your understanding, or what did your understanding become to be of souls and animals?
Well, our concept of the soul has changed over the centuries. Back in ancient times, in the early strands of the biblical tradition, the soul was just identified as the mystery of life. Sometimes it was identified with the breath, sometimes with the blood. It says in the second chapter of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, that God created Adam in the garden and saw that Adam was lonely, bestowed on Adam a living soul, nefesh chayim in Hebrew, and gave to the animals also nefesh chayim. So there wasn't any differentiation or distinction between the souls of animals and the souls the human race. And it was only much later that, this kind of gulf or chasm opened up between the human species and the rest. So by the time you get to, for instance, the King James translation into English, you know, in more modern times, you'll read that God created Adam as a living soul and the others as living creatures, but it's just a mistranslation.
Yeah, so it's interesting how we went, you know, from that concept of the soul to the concept that animals were machines and that they were just to be used for human purposes.
Oh, right. Well, animals are not at all machines. Animals are living, sensitive beings like ourselves. We've co-evolved with animals. And, you know, scientists recognize this. Conrad Lorenz was kind of the grandfather of modern animal biology, and he said projecting human emotions like love onto other species, that's not a case of anthropomorphizing. That's not projecting human characteristics onto to animals. That's just recognizing animal characteristics in human beings. You know, we're capable of love, affection, grief, jealousy, and all those social emotions because, like geese or other primates or other social animals, they help us to keep our place within our troop, our clan, our family. So, you know, it's very natural and very beautiful and mysterious at the same time.
And what about, you know, right versus wrong? Did you sort of come to a realization about that when you're working on the souls of animals?
It's a question of what you mean by right and wrong, and, and what is a moral sense. Probably animals don't reflect consciously in quite the way that a university-trained ethicist would. But, you know, most of us don't rise to that level of reflection either. We have some gut feeling about what's the right thing to do in certain occasions. And, you know, animal altruism is so well documented.
Yeah,
there was this experiment that took place back in the 60s where rhesus monkeys, known as macaques also, were trained to sit in a chair and pull a chain to get their ration to receive food. And the little monkeys, of course, quickly learned how to pull the chain. You know, they're very bright. And then a second monkey was introduced behind a one-way mirror in another chair in another room. Now every time the first monkey pulled the chain to get his food, the second monkey would get an electrical shock. And, you know, the first one could see the other one in real suffering there. And it turned out that almost all of the monkeys were conscientious objectors. They were dissidents or resistors. They refused to go along with this experimental protocol. One of the monkeys went without food, just sitting in the chair, in a restraining chair, for 2 weeks without eating, rather than, you know, shocking its companion. It was supposed to be an experiment on the effects of kinship, on altruism. You know, would it make a difference if the two monkeys were biologically related, cousins or uncle and nephew or something like that? It turned out that that didn't have any bearing on predicting the behavior of the monkeys. What had bearing was whether the first monkey had had an opportunity to sit in that other chair and walk a mile in the other person's moccasins. So I think animals often, you know, compare very, very favorably with their human counterparts when it comes to moral behavior. These monkeys were really moral heroes in a way.
And sometimes better.
I've seen a lot of research recently that has delved into the ethics and the moral behavior of, in most part, primates.
Yeah.
And it's always amusing to me in a way that we find this so amazing that they have a sense of ethics. It's something that we felt all along.
Sure. You know, it's certainly evident in the great apes. There was that incident about 10 years ago in the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago. A little toddler, you know, a three-year-old boy, managed to climb over the enclosure of the gorilla's place there in the zoo and fell down and bumped his head. And, well, gorillas are territorial. Some of the males were upset and making threatening gestures towards this little boy who'd invaded their space. And one of the females who had her own baby clinging to her the way gorilla's mothers carry their babies around, she went over and picked up the little boy and carried him to the exit and waited there, guarding him, keeping him safe until a zoo attendant could appear and, you know, bring the medics along. So is that surprising that mother love crosses the species line? I don't think so. You know, it's just good science. If you think about it, we all descend from a common mother, don't we? That's what Darwin said. That's the meaning of evolution. So somewhere back there about, you know, several million years ago, 4 or 5 million years ago, we all share a common mother. The chimps, the humans, the orangutans. So why is it surprising to think that mother love is a trait that's common to us all?
And, you know, I guess these stories of animals and just how amazing they are seem to continue to come out all the time. And it looks like you continue that work in Blessings of the Animals, celebrating our kinship with all creation. What are some of the newest stories that you've heard about really just how amazing these animals are?
I deal with some different species in Blessings of the Animals, and this is a book that grew out of the interspecies celebrations that I typically hold each year in the churches that I serve. But I learned a lot in writing the book. For instance, there's a chapter on worm charming. I don't know if you're familiar
No.
with worm charming, but there's an international worm charming competition that takes place in Great Britain every year, and it's also an art that's practiced in Appalachia and the southeastern territories of the United States. What you do is you take something like a tomato steak and you drive it about 8 or 10 inches into the ground, and then you take maybe a rusty old saw or a piece of metal, and you begin to bow that stake like a fiddle to create a vibration. And I tried this out in my backyard. I actually was able to rouse a few worms this way. You have to get just the right tone. You have to imagine what a marauding mole sounds like to a worm as it's burrowing under the surface. It's kind of a rrr, 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 you get going. And the worms rise up. But it's very interesting, going back to Darwin. He wrote a whole tome about earthworms and studied their intelligence, thought that they were quite bright for being such simple organisms. They're blind. They don't need eyes. But they're very sensitive to vibration. And he carried out experiments with them. Worms are in the habit of capping their burrows. They usually pull a little plug of leaf or twig over the top, maybe to keep out the rain, maybe to keep it warm inside. But he took different shapes of leaves and different kinds of leaves, and he found that the worms would uniformly select the narrow end of the leaf to drag it down its hole. You can imagine if you were trying to pull a leaf down a narrow burrow, you'd have to select the right end, not the fat end, but the thin end. So Darwin thought that these even worms had an awareness of their environment, and he was a humanitarian in his own way. He continued to be an angler and fish throughout his life, but whenever he would bait the hook, he would first dip the worm into brine to anesthetize it so that it wouldn't feel the shock of being impaled there.
Wow. And what about swarm intelligence? I saw something about this in your book.
Yeah. Swarm intelligence. It's an up-and-coming science, but social insects like ants and bees. Well, ants, you know, I have a chapter on ants. You talk about animals as robots. When you get down to the level of insects, they even look like robots. You know, they've got that exoskeleton, and they go clanking and clattering along. But you take one ant, and it seems to be a kind of mindless automaton just carrying out a stereotyped set of behaviors. But then you get them in a collection, and thousands of ants together can turn out to be very smart and adaptive and problem solvers. So now airline companies, telecommunication companies are studying the way that ants communicate in their hives as they're trying to design faster, more efficient phone systems and routing systems for airline scheduling and so forth.
It's amazing stuff, Gary.
Swarm intelligence, right.
Yeah. Can you tell our listeners how to learn more about possibly buying your books?
Oh, yeah, sure. The titles are all available on Amazon, or you can order them from your local bookstore, or you can visit my website, which is www.kowalskibooks.com. That's K-O-W-A-L-S-K-I books.
We've been talking with Reverend Gary Kowalski, author and minister. Thanks so much for being with us, Gary.
Hey, thank you.
Fourth of July is quickly approaching, and many pets often try to escape from their yards and can get hit by cars. So don't forget to protect your pets and bring them inside during the fireworks shows.
If you'd like to learn more about a vegetarian diet and what's going on locally to support vegetarianism, you can visit our website at vsep.org. That's the Vegetarian Society of El Paso.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you'll find them at ktep.org. Just click the listen button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Another beautiful morning under stars and bars and F-Series pickups and rusted out cars and they're eating breakfast at the strip bar just to have a peek in the piss of angels spread their wings and they dream of swinnies and diamonds and things. And somehow that might ease a stain for the company they keep. Yeah. And the vets still talk about the tail defensive, and the freshman boys all look so pensive. Cause living large is so expensive. Hope daddy filled the jet. And we'll fly out to the Hard Rock Casino. We'll put on our neatly pressed and fine chinos. And we'll laugh at the guy in the El Camino. Is that the only car he could get? It's a beautiful life. It's just as advertised.